And welcome back, and good morning to everyone out there. You are listening to Community Living Radio. At this time, I am going to make a program announcement that Kelly has taken a leave of absence. So I guess everyone's kind of stuck with me. And today, we have Paul Gilbert coming on, and we're going to talk about some issues that neglect as / abuse issues around people with disabilities in care, and maybe some people could be experiencing these things who aren't necessarily in care. So, and maybe we can get into some politics around this, but what our government could be doing better to help people in these situations. So, Paul, are you there?
Hi there, Michael. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah. So,
one of the things that I keep on coming across, the circumstances facing the disabled in BC keeps on reminding me of is that we have the same rights as everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
People, we're often treated as though we're asking for extra, but the fact of the matter is we're not getting what everybody else gets, and that's usually the problem.
Yeah.
So, when the government determines disability policy, if they were to determine policy around women, they'd talk to women. Mm-hmm. They'd involve women in determining those policies. If they were going to talk to Indigenous people, same thing, or racialized minorities, the same thing. Because good decisions come from involving the people who were affected.
Yeah. I would like to think that they would come to the Indigenous or the visible minority populations to discuss rights and things.
Yes,
I would like to think they would.
Indigenous nearly as much as they should.
Yeah.
The indisability, the catch cry around that is nothing about us without us, because when we're involved in change, that's when good change happens. And that's been around for mm-hmm. decades now.
It's a very true statement.
Yeah, it's very succinct. Yeah, the problem is that the leadership team that the government has looking over the development and implementation of disability policy in BC doesn't have anybody with a disability on it. They have service providers
mm-hmm.
who basically are dependent upon government for their funding, and not a lot of radicals in that group. And they have CEOs for Vancity and the Vancouver Airport Authority from a thing called the President's Group. They're a group of CEOs that are using the disabled in their marketing campaigns. I don't say they're helping the disabled in employment. They're using them in their marketing campaigns, and that's what these groups are like. There's one in the UK that called the Employers Forum on Disability, and that's all it's about, really. They give each other awards, and they promote themselves as being disability friendly, and they're often federal regulated employers that are supposed to be counting how many people with disabilities they deal with. These sorts of things haven't worked. Oh, we have a bureaucrat on there and somebody selling RDSPs. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they're not talking to the disabled.
Right.
We were doing a marketing campaign last month. We put together a video, and it starts off with a couple of sentences. I'm tired of all the well-meaning non-cripples determining what I can and cannot do to form my life and my future. Get out of our way. I thought that captured it really nicely, because we don't need people who wanna feel good helping us, we need, and not letting us speak. The disabled need a voice.
Right, right, and that's the important thing to rights is actually the first and foremost most important right is the right to have a voice in the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, that's so often been the case with any marginalized group. The first thing they do is they silence you. They pretend that we don't exist. It's 77%, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but 77% of the people with disabilities in the Canadian Human Rights Commission's findings last year, their work, were people with disabilities or people with mental health problems. But when the BC government announced their recreation of the Human Rights Commission, or the BC Human Rights Commission, they didn't even mention the disabled. We're the largest percentage of their claims, but they didn't mention us. What's happening?
Something's wrong there, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Being noticed and being listened to is really important. In any of these things. The government, that group that has no disabled people on it, came out with a report called Building a Better CBC in 2017, and basically it's a bunch of things the Liberals did and some bad policy decisions that the NDP are making. It's interesting. Having the same rights as everybody else in BC or in most places involves recognition that we're not there, we're not excluded because we have an impairment. If you have and the medical model says you're less able if you have a disability, but the social model says we're disabled by society. The impairment is we all have impairments if we have a disability, but the impairment isn't the thing that's keeping us down. It's bad attitudes. It's prejudice.
Yes, prejudice. That is an excellent word. Prejudice and if you have a prejudice, how can you advocate for rights for that same group? Right.
Yeah.
So in. The prejudice in this case, it may not necessarily be a hatred. It's just the idea that, well, we know he can't really do this, so we'll have to just take over for him.
Yeah.
And that's really the attitude that some people have when it comes to advocating for rights. It's like I think everybody knows what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. So. I think most people with disabilities are your audience, so we've all experienced it.
Yeah. In also being an Indigenous and a visible minority, I've seen this from multiple directions. That a person who's standing there saying, "Well, I just want to help you, but you're shutting me up."
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah. I was years ago. You reminded me. I helped a friend of mine get out of a care home. He'd been stuck in this care home because of something that happened. I think he got arrested for something, and he ended up in this care home. And they wouldn't do anything for him. They wouldn't let him out. And I finally had a meeting with the doctor that was overseeing his case. I did that by taking him out and going to another doctor and having the doctor intercede. They didn't say a word to him. The whole meeting, nobody said a word to him. Nobody asked his opinion, nothing. I was in this position where I had to promote what he wanted me to say without them me caring whether what he wanted to say. But we did get him out of the care home.
Well... At least that's kind of the good part, right?
Yeah.
So.
But it goes to show you that they accommodating people with disabilities is seen as an inconvenience most of the time.
Yeah.
But the issue around violence and people in institutions and people outside of institutions, they just did that big settlement not long ago for the people in Woodlands.
Yes.
At the same time, they were announcing funding for domestic violence services,
mm-hmm.
which didn't include the disabled. So there's a number of reasons why that's the case. There's a man I was watching recently. He said he's a black civil rights person in the U.S. and a very, very prominent lawyer and a number of things. He's quite impressive. He was saying that if you were going to talk about, when you talk about historic actions like lynchings and slavery and things like that, and most people would say that if they were the back then, they'd be opposed. Most people think that they'd be marching with Martin Luther King. But if you're not prepared to stand up against injustice today, it's unlikely you would have done it in the past, because it was just part of the milieu.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the disabled are found, you find a lot of people with disabilities on the street, well, half of them at least, are people on the street are disabled. Those are human rights, and those are injustices that should be dealt with today, that in historic terms, we might look back and see, I certainly would have fought for that in the past. But unless you're willing to, the mindset, unless you're willing to recognize that the things that in the past you consider outrageous, you wouldn't have stood against them at the time if you're not willing to stand against things that are happening now.
Right. That makes perfect sense.
Standing up for things is uncomfortable and sometimes leads to financial costs. And I know my ex-wife didn't like it when I was involved in human rights issues. it took time away from her. I don't know. It's normal for people, for your peers and employer or what have you, to oppose social action.
Yeah, so sometimes it's easy for people to look at, look what happened in the past. I would have stood against that. It's easy for them to look in retrospect of what they say they would stand against now because the change has been made. But go ahead, let's see that same person. Let's see how many of those same people would stand up for any number of issues that are going on now, rather be right a human rights issue, environmental issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Those
are I think we need to remember when you're looking at human rights struggles in the past is that they're looked at through sort of inaccurate lenses. People think that Martin Luther King was celebrated. He was vilified. People hated him.
Well, I guess the most famed rights activist, and when you look at the history of our world, is of course Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Right? What did they do to him? And how many people stood up and said, "You can't kill him."
Yes.
How many people did that?
Yeah.
It's still the same attitudes. It's like you said, it isn't comfortable standing up, as sometimes it is not safe.
No, definitely not safe. Especially where around lynchings and things like that were happening. I always think the interesting, somebody drew a parallel between lynchings and the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree, And they saw basically it as the same issue. Somebody's standing up trying to live a life and not be, and they just get picked up and lynched.
Right. it is very similar. I would say that is a very valid parallel.
Yeah. So. It's scary, but I mean, in normal life, I mean, if you're in school or work or what have you, if you're going to get along with your peers, you keep your mouth shut sometimes because there's a lot of social pressure to conform.
Right.
It's hard to be for people to stand out.
Yeah.
I got a really bad habit when I was growing up because I moved every year. So by the time they've got around to punishing me for standing out, I was gone. That really, when I started staying in one place for extended periods, I learned that was that I didn't really even realize that I was going to get punished until I stayed in one place for a while.
Yeah.
You don't stand out. You don't. It's like if you get promoted at work, people dislike it.
Yeah.
They feel that they should have been able to get that chance or what have you, or they just, it just makes them uncomfortable for one reason or another. But I've noticed that standing out, trying to do better work. There's a thing in business from the 30s where they talked about the informal social network in organizations, and it's actually informally, people set quality standards and production standards as a group that differ from what management wants.
Mm-hmm.
So that they pressure each other to conform to the standards that they have as a group, as people. But that's a sort of an example of just day-to-day social pressure to conform.
Right.
But, yeah. I digress.
Yeah. But it's important to note that because I grew up I was actually born at the end of in the U.S. at the end of Jim Crow.
Wow.
Martin Luther King. Listen, John F. Kennedy was killed 3 years before I was born, and Martin Luther King was killed 2 years after I was born. So you get the flavor of what's going on. It's like Bay of Pigs, the Cold War, and Vietnam. All those sort of things are happening. And by the time we got past that stuff. And when I'm actually really growing up and going through school, oh, you don't have to worry about him. He's a good in.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, Tinder, what? I was like, what the heck are they? At first, I was like, I was naive to what the heck they were talking about. And eventually, it hit me. It was like, oh, because I was seen as the conformist,
yeah.
But I was actually one of the people actually screaming the loudest, "Hey, everybody needs to have the same exact rights."
Yeah,
because I wasn't screaming that. Oh, my family was enslaved in the 1800s. Because I wasn't screaming that, and I was just saying that if he gets that right, then this person should have the same exact right, regardless of race, creed, or, you know, however the saying goes.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. I mean, and what happened with the blacks in the U.S. is they got slave, they got free of slavery, kind of, and they got nothing.
That's
at the same
point.
Time they were giving white Europeans land in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So here you had a whole bunch of people who were marginalized and despised by their communities or by the broader community that didn't want to do anything for them, and often tried to reinforce slavery despite the fact it was supposed to be gone. They had nothing, and this government did nothing for them.
Right.
It really, yeah. really explains why. But I mean, with prejudice and discrimination that have happened ever since. I mean, in the U.S., you still have communities. Black communities are still denied mortgages,
mm-hmm.
And such things as that. Their schools are still underfunded because they're usually in poor areas.
Right.
There's an incredible number of problems that just aren't being addressed. It's the same as the disabled community. I see a lot of similarities between the indigenous population in both Canada and the U.S. and the American civil rights, black civil rights movement.
Yeah.
That I just wish we had their vibrancy.
Okay, let's get back to that in a second, because there's a few parallels there that we can go through in the next segment. So just hang on there, Paul, and I'll be right back. Okay, and we're back. You're listening to Community Living Radio, and we're speaking with Paul Gilbert about what's amounting to be a very interesting human rights talk around disabilities and all around human rights. So thanks for joining us again today, Paul.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So... one of the things that you had said, and I remember this growing up, that we used to call a certain group of people do-gooders.
Oh.
And you find a lot of those with people dealing with people with disabilities. And in your opinion, are they do-gooders?
It's quite true that, yes, well, even family members... of people with disabilities, the studies say that they don't really understand their experiences. And this is, I mean, in my experience, this is quite true. I mean, in examples like looking for work, they don't really get it, why it is that their child or sibling or brother or what have you is having so much trouble finding work. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't listen to the fact that they're just being systematically excluded.
Yeah.
They can't get their head around it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for us to get our heads around it. The fact that it takes a long time often for people to develop the consciousness around the discrimination that we face. And so do-gooders often are people who don't really understand what's going on. It's one of the things you encounter when you get supports or aid from something like a vocational rehab consultant or a employment services provider. They don't really get the marginalization you're facing.
No.
So they pressure you and punish you if things don't work out fast.
Yeah. You know,
it's your fault.
Yes. You didn't try hard enough, or I told you what you should have done, but you just didn't do what I told you.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's one of the things, like, I was, it happens all the time. I mean, yes, on both sides. I think do-gooders are disliked by people who don't want to support people who are trying, who need support, but also they're a problem for people who need support because they don't really understand what they're doing.
Right.
The well-meaning non-cripples, determining what I can and cannot do for my life and my future.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think that's one of the problems that I can. We've been working our way through ministers in the government and finding basically, I mean, the NDP might take offense at this, and or NDP partisans might take offense at this, but they're oblivious.
Yeah, well, and as we said before, that the people that you're trying to help have to be involved in the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, because how do you know what I need until you can walk in my shoes?
Yeah. It's that one of the first things, if you don't learn when you're doing counseling, you do really rotten counseling.
Yeah.
Often found that junior counselors, when they start working, they give people lots of advice, but they haven't listened to them at all.
Oh, I know exactly what your problem is, and this is how we're going to fix it.
Yes, here's some resources you can access.
Right.
But awful.
Yeah.
It's like diagnosing somebody without asking them a single question.
You can diagnose somebody without asking a single question?
No, but people think you can.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not that these well-meaning people are bad. They just don't get it. When women shelters don't make themselves accessible to people with disabilities, they're not being nasty towards them. They just don't get it. And so, and the funding that's set up is for a heteronormative level types of abuse. It's not the sort of abuse people with disabilities suffer, domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
The rates for physical and sexual abuse among the disabled are 2 to 3 times higher than the non-disabled. But we don't have the services. We don't have access to shelters.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently their funding is tied to actually helping people who fit the criteria of heteronormative. Where the sexual issues are involved, or physical issues, or violence issues are involved. But if you're disabled, often the abuse comes down to putting your medication on a shelf that you can't reach. And it always has to be a partner. It can't be a carer that's abusing you. You're not escaping a carer isn't relevant, and a lot of these things really go back to senior abuse as well. That the sort of abuse seniors suffer, they do suffer sexual and physical abuse, but they also suffer this sort of neglect that's not really something that's looked at in the law. So if you go to court and try to get help, try to get a protection order.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do anything for you.
Well, it's kind of interesting. In some cases, we will do something about the neglect of an animal, but the neglect of a person can be swept under the rug because, the medication's there, but the person who needs to be able to take it can't reach it. It's just out of reach.
Yeah.
But if you were to do that to, say, a pet,
yeah, put the water bowl out of reach for them, so that they're starving.
Right. Exactly. That's just horrible. But we can do that to, for instance, is of course the seniors, where they need that medication at a certain time or whatever, and they have to wait for someone else to get it, but it can't be put within their reach.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like you said, it's something that simple, but the laws don't provide for that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that's expanding this issue around abuse. We have to look at changing the criminal code and changing the BC laws or BC legislation to expand those focuses. And once again, it's the problem is that the charities can raise an issue like this after they've done a study, and then they have to shut up. They can't pressure the elected officials to do something. They can't protest it. They can't do anything except they can do a report and release it. That grassroots advocacy is really needed to move anything forward, because the system with charities is designed to silence them. They can't do advocacy beyond 10% if they're a registered charity, and they can't be involved in politics, period.
Right.
So, and so much of what we do as the Disability Caucus is involvement in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Involvement and we do advocacy continually. So we'd never be able to be a charity.
No.
Terrible status immediately. Excuse me. Cindy Blackstock is a good example of somebody who did something really important. Are you familiar with the Jordan's Principle?
Not exactly. Why don't you go ahead and explain that?
Well, the Jordan's Principle says that a child, an Indigenous child, deserves to be treated the same way in healthcare as a non-Indigenous child.
Okay, yeah.
You can't, Indigenous children don't receive the same level of care. They get, the Indigenous communities get a third less of the resources that go to the rest of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact you won this case, there's still, the government still doesn't want to increase funding to Indigenous populations. But that, to actually win that case, she had to lose. She had a national nonprofit. It lost all its funding. As soon as she went to court, she lost all her funding. Because you don't do that sort of thing if you want to get along with government.
Right.
And get funding. But she won. So she made a major step forward for Indigenous rights for children.
Yeah, that's a... Okay, she won the case, but now how is the government going to take up and actually fix the problem?
That's the problem. I remember seeing shortly after that about the findings on the UN and the human rights cases the government lost, where they were ordered to increase funding for Indigenous communities. Justin Trudeau said, well, they wouldn't know what to spend the money on. I mean, they don't have clean water. They don't have proper sewage treatment. Their schools are in a mess, and there's not enough resources for students. There's suicides happening because these children are isolated, and there's a historical genocide that's still happening.
Right.
But they don't know where to spend the money.
It's like, here's a list. Pick one, right?
Trudeau is a racist.
That is a debatable topic.
Yes, I know. I'm going overboard on CRTC rules. Some weekend you have to get a liberal to say, "Oh, Justin Trudeau is a wonderful human being," on here to compensate for me.
We'll fix that problem at a later date.
But it's just that when the problem is that we've got the Indigenous populations isolated and they're in desperate need of all sorts of services. But my point was that when you do fight for human rights, you do get punished by the state.
Mm-hmm.
The system is designed to punish you. So,
yes, it is. It is designed that way. In a lot of different ways, financially, status-wise, right? That if you, if say you were a public figure and you went too far with the protests, that that you find yourself in a whole bunch of trouble in the public eye, right?
Yeah.
All sorts of ways they have of making sure that you get punished for protesting a little bit too hard or too far.
So. Yes, yes. That's one of the things that the major charities didn't refuse to attend any of the protests that we held.
Mm-hmm.
It would have embarrassed government if they were there protesting, so they didn't come.
Oh.
So it was up to the grassroots. It was up to individuals with disabilities to come out, and they did. But the people who claimed to represent them were silent.
Hmm.
And apparently the people who are speaking for them and to the government aren't even disabled and often have completely different agendas than doing anything to help the disabled. They're PR people or people selling RDSPs to us or what have you. They're service providers. They don't have any reason to actually speak for us or any necessary understanding about what we experience.
Yeah.
So I hate to see somebody. I would be amazed if somebody who's the CEO of Van City or the Vancouver Airport Authority was making less than $100,000 a year and understood what it's like to actually have to struggle to eat.
Yeah.
Because poverty and disability go hand in hand.
Yeah. They did. I guess there was somebody that that decided that he would spend a couple weeks living that sort of thing. But at the end of the couple weeks, he knew that he could go back. So
it's just like fasting for a little bit.
Yeah. And I often wonder how much of a statement did it really make?
Yeah.
So, because I haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of change in the direction of helping just as something as simple as affordable housing.
Yes.
So.
Yes, and I mean the with affordable housing and with all sorts of, one of the things that is overlooked, despite the fact that there was huge gains in understanding the social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm.
You're still expected, if you're on disability benefits, to find some place to rent for $375 a month.
Yeah.
Well, there aren't any places to rent for $375 a month.
That is very, very true. And let me get a couple messages in here, and we'll be right back. Okay? Hang on, Paul. We're talking to Paul Gilbert of the Disability Caucus. You're in Victoria, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. That's a pretty good place to be, to keep an eye on what the government's actually doing, isn't it?
Yes, and if I had a better arm, I could throw a rock at the legislature. It seems like it's close enough. I can actually see it from where I live.
Oh, wow.
But I've always been amazed at how government, as soon as they get into power, they isolate themselves, and it's very hard to actually get them they seem to keep everything on the quiet and then make announcements patting themselves on the back. But they're not really accessible like they used to be.
No, before they got in. I know of a few of the people that they were way more accessible. The phone would ring every now and again, right? Hey, how's it going? And it's like, I understand they're busy, but at the same time, it's like, the occasional check-in to let me know hey, what can I say on air about, as the previous issue was mentioned, affordable housing? It's not one of those situations where everyone's going to beat up on them. Just say something so we know that you're actually working on it, right?
Yeah.
So.
Well, also just the being able to well, we really hoped that and we promoted this. We really hoped that the government would establish a Ministry of Disability Issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because the awareness of disability issues is so bad in the government. And the charities have not been able to raise things. I mean, nobody's been raising the issue of marriage equity for people with disabilities. Ever. We started doing that, and it's come up over and over again. People are getting tired of us talking about it and want us to get some results, but it's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And things like access to accessible to information, that's a human right. You don't see the charities coming up with that very much. Well, some of them do, actually. Mm-hmm. But there's a host of issues that affect the disabled, but because the charities can't advocate, they can't say much. So the government doesn't have anybody telling them that they're going the wrong direction, and they need to actually organize a ministry that focuses on what direction needs to happen. And filling a committee full of non-disabled corporate executives, etc., is not going to do that.
No, that's not going to do it. You need somebody on that committee that is actually going to say something, you know, say something that is valuable to the people who are going to be the recipients of the policy in general, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, there's another group out there. They're called the Semiamu Self Advocates.
Yes, I know Semiamu. I have years and decades ago, I had a client that was connected to them.
Yeah. Well, I live just about right around the corner from them, and my arm is actually strong enough that I could hit their front door with a stone. So there, Paul. No, but there is a young man that's actually involved with them. His name is Alexander Matheson. And he has autism, and I saw him at a federal forum. Was a federal person involved with the ministry in charge of people of helping people with disabilities, and they were going to come with this revamp the Disability Act and all that sort of stuff, right? And he actually stood up in the room. He said, "Hire me as a consultant to help you put this policy in place."
Yeah.
There was no acknowledgement to it at all, of course, but it was like, that's it right there, is somebody who's brave enough to step up to the plate and say, hey, I have a disability, now I want to actually help consult with you to get the right policies in place. I think that would be an absolute brilliant idea.
Yeah, it would be. They having lots of people with disabilities involved is important, so that the many voices are heard.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're a very diverse population. I think we're probably the most diverse population there is.
Yeah.
They don't. We're discounted. I think the government dismisses us all the time, as far as being important. And some people that they have to listen to. But, yeah. So, I mean, what's happening with these? I mean, there's all sorts of issues. I didn't want to come on and do a wine fest. because things like Minister of Education Rob Fleming not giving people access to accessible print so that people who are blind or have dyslexia or what have you can access it throughout the province, like they do in other provinces.
Right.
He's also was made the news this last week or so because apparently they're still restraining and secluding students with disabilities that they don't know what how to deal with. And one of the first things I did years ago when I started working with children who are autistic was I learned behavioral management strategies that were non-aversive. And I had a psychology degree, so the idea of using aversive methods, I learned early on that doesn't work. Punishment is not a way to get people to behave.
It's kind of interesting that way, isn't it?
So yeah, you have to get strategies in place that encourage people to do things that are not going to get them in trouble, and that's not that difficult to do. But there's specialists out there that do that, but they cost money. Mm-hmm. So I guess what Rob Fleming was looking for French teachers a little while ago, traveling the world, and some of that money maybe should have gone to developing strategies to help these children to not run into problems, rather than secluding them and actually restraining them. I mean, that's not something that should be happening in this decade.
Yeah. As far as my oldest stepson, he was diagnosed with ADHD, and I knew we never got anywhere with his plan for education.
Individual education plan.
Yeah, he never got anywhere with it. He was supposed to be handed some because he had had trouble with fine motor skills. So writing wasn't always a possibility. It was slow and laborious for him. So, but he could keyboard. So he was supposed to be given a laptop or a tablet. And I saw a bunch of equipment go into the school, and I was like, I ran into the school shortly afterwards, and to make sure that my son's going to get what he's supposed to have today. Yes, this is an exciting moment, right? Nope. And it was just amazing. He graduated and never received anything that was on that plan.
Yeah. Yeah, and even far beyond that, they didn't even do testing to find out what people's barriers were because they cost money. They didn't. Mm-hmm. People graduated without even having them being assessed.
Yeah.
We're not a priority, and it's frustrating, and we're not going to be able to get government to change its mind unless we tell them that they need to change their mind. But this is happening everywhere. I sent Melanie Mark, the Minister of Advanced Education, a report on the way people are treated in schools in post-secondary. Mm-hmm. And it's the same problem. You can't get your accommodation. Imagine, my own personal experience, I was taking an accounting class, and I got the accommodation after the class was finished. So I continued doing the accounting after everybody was working on something else. It took so long that this is something that they supposedly have people in the school that help you prepare, help accommodate you, but they don't look forward and say, okay, you're going to need accommodation in this, so that's going to happen next year, let's set it up now. No, they don't do that.
No, they clearly do not do that.
But on top of that, you have prejudice and discrimination coming from fellow students and instructors. That's a constant problem for people with disabilities in university and in school. And you have the exclusion that goes on, where somebody with a disability, people don't know how to respond to them. They think they see them as different. Mm-hmm. They don't engage them. So you're to a large extent, a lot of, some people have really nice stories about childhood because they grew up in an environment where they didn't feel excluded at all. But a lot of people did, and eventually you end up running into that problem.
Yeah.
You have to deal with the fact that you're not part of their, you're an out-group member.
Right.
But these, Mitzi Dean, minister, representative for women's equity, said there's going to have to be a societal shift for people with disabilities to have their rights recognized. Well, the government's not participating in anything that would help that. And that's one of the reasons why we need a Ministry of Disability Issues.
Right.
They have to recognize that our rights are important and that they're hurting us. They're hurting people.
Yeah. So, we're down to the last 4 minutes. Why don't you tell people how to get a hold of the BC Disability Caucus again, so they can join in the conversation with you guys to help push things forward, so there can be a real conversation in government.
Yes, they can find us at BC Disability on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at BC_Disability, and on LinkedIn. They can reach out to us. We answer people's questions. We have a group right now that's very fairly active on marriage equity for Canadians with disabilities.
Yeah,
connected to the caucus as a subgroup. We do that, but there's only so many subgroups we can handle. We're all volunteer driven and poor, so everything is done because people are determined to see it happen.
Yeah.
We're not doing this. We're doing this because it needs to be done.
Right.
We don't get. We're not being paid. But yeah, they're welcome. We welcome people to come take a look and to engage in conversations and share things that are happening to them and ask advice.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with the fight and the conversation, and hopefully we'll start to see some real changes in our society, you know, where the prejudices that we've talked about disappear and the programs increase to make everything equal for everyone.
Yes, we have hope. You can't do any advocacy without hope.
Yes. I think hope is one of the most important things that we have as human beings.
Oh yes, it's essential.
Yes, so hope is good. I made a program announcement earlier that that Kelly has took a leave of absence. He stepped away for a little bit. He's got some stuff to deal with, and we hope that he hurries back quickly and we can have him rejoin the conversation, because we all kind of miss him, right?
I'd like to see Kelly back.
Yeah.
Kelly's been is a staple.
That's right.
A staple of a voice of people with disabilities in the community.
Yeah. So he does great work as far as advocacy. So and we'd like to see him hurry back. Whatever he's dealing with, hopefully it won't take him too long, and he'll be back. So, all right. So, thank you for joining us this morning, Paul, and everyone listening to.